My name is Jack. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 8th, 1986. I am a member in good standings of the Traditions Group in Memphis, Tennessee. We meet on Mondays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays at 8 p.m. Last Saturday of the month, we have the best potluck dinner you can get in Memphis, Tennessee. If you're in the area, please look us up. We will make you feel welcome and at home. I first want to thank everybody for letting me come and speak. I want to apologize for not being here for the weekend, but first things first, and I have to work. So, you know, my mortgage company expects a check each month. And I was going to come up last night, but it ended up that by the time I got off work, I was sitting there and I'm looking at the clock and I'm saying, man, I'm going to get there about 1 o'clock in the morning. So I'm thinking, well, you know what I'll do is I'll just go to bed, get up at 3:30, leave at 4. I can be up there and everything will be fine. My wife was going to come. 3:30 this morning, she says, you know, I'll support you, but not this morning. So needless to say, Bridget didn't come, but she's here in spirit. You know, the first time I spoke, I was told by my sponsor that I was going to speak three times. The first one was going to be the one on the way to the meeting, the one during the meeting, and the one on the way home critiquing what I said. So for your sake, I hope this is the better of the three. Okay? I believe that life is a bed of roses. But I believe to get up there and to smell that beautiful fragrance and to see those beautiful sculpture of the petals, you're going to get pricked by a few thorns along the way. Now, during my story, you're going to hear some of these pricks that I've received along the way. When I first came into these rooms, you people told me it was going to get better. Now, what I thought you meant was there'd be no more thorns. That's what I was expecting. But what I found out is that what was going to be better was the way that I dealt with the thorns and the way I was able to get through them. You know, and for that I'm grateful. A little bit about who I am. I was raised in Southern California. I had a great childhood. I did not have abusive parents, so I don't have that to blame onto my alcoholism. My father was quite a jokester, and I was the fourth pregnancy of my mother's. My brother, who some of you know, who's 11 years older than I was, and then my parents had a daughter who died at 12 months, and then she had a miscarriage, and then I came along. And my father, all my life, and I think if he would have ever thought that he was hurting me or I don't think it left scars, but that it bothered me, I don't believe he would have said it, because he was a very loving man. But he used to call me the accident, the mistake. And he said, you know, he says, we just bought your mom a brand new car, and then she gets pregnant, we had to sell her new car, get her this old used car. And that's kind of how I grew up, always thinking that, man, how much better their life would have been if I would have not have been born, you know? And they compared me to my older brother. Now, my older brother, being 11 years older, keep in mind, when he was a senior in high school, I was in kindergarten. So he was my hero, and I looked up to this guy. And my father would tell me many times, man, Joe used to do this. Why can't you be more like... And I always, and that was how I grew up my life. I just felt like I just didn't measure up. I just didn't fit in. And I think when I took my first drink of alcohol, I believe, and I was a late bloomer. I think I was a freshman in high school when I got drunk for the first time. But I remember when I took that drink, and I remember that just going, and I was just like, oh, I feel good now. I felt like I did fit in. See, because in high school, I wanted to date the cheerleaders and I wanted to hang out with the football players, but I didn't feel like I was good enough to associate with them. I didn't fit into their circle. But when I drank, I did. I had courage to ask the girls out. I had courage to hang out with the guys. And I think the first time that I ever heard that there might be a drinking problem, I was a sophomore in high school, and I'd been going out with this young lady, and we were going to a party. And she told me, she says, let's do something different tonight, and let's not drink. And I thought, not drink? You know, see, because from the time I had that first drink, that's what I was always trying to capture, was that feeling again. Because, see, that made me feel like somebody, made me feel good. And that's what I kept chasing all the years I drank. And I said, well, why do we not want to drink? We're going to a party. And she said, well, you know, Jack, she goes, when we go to these, and, or when we drink, she goes, things happen. She goes, one, sometimes we do things we shouldn't be doing. It's dangerous. And, you know, we're just, you know, we don't need that to have fun. Well, that was probably the first time that I promised to a female that I wouldn't drink again or drink that time, in which obviously during my life there was many. And I promised her that that's fine, we won't drink tonight. Well, we get to the party. She goes to the one direction with where all the girls are. My buddies grab me. I go into the kitchen. He says, let's get you a beer. He opens up the refrigerator. The kid's house, it was, his parents were gone. They had removed everything out of the refrigerator, including the shelves, and it was full of Budweiser cans of beer. And I said, no, I'm not drinking tonight. What do you mean you're not drinking tonight? And I said, no, I made a deal with Teresa. We're just not going to drink tonight. He says, Jack, you got a drink? He says, just take one and put in your hand and sip on it. And he says, so you'll fit in. Well, as soon as he said that, I was done. Because now, that's what I wanted to do, right, was fit in. So, needless to say, I'm not sure exactly how that young lady got home that night, because I didn't take her. I obviously got pretty polluted. And the next thing I remember was my mother waking me up that Saturday morning, or Sunday morning, whatever morning it was, and saying that Teresa's on the phone, she wants to talk to you. She goes, I don't know what you did, but she is extremely upset. So I go to the telephone, and she says, I don't really want to talk to you. I don't want to see you again, but I just would like to get my purse back, and it's in your car. And would you please bring it to me? And I took her purse that day. We never spoke or talked again until the night before graduation at graduation rehearsal, and the school had a real sense of humor. They put us next to each other so in our seating. But anyway, and that's fine, because that was the first time anybody had ever told me something like that. And alcohol worked very well for me for a long, long time. At least I thought it did. Now, when I went to college, I didn't finish because these professors, I don't know what their problem is, but they just have a real problem if you come in and you're drunk and you're, you know, sleeping with your head on their desk and drooling all over and snoring and, you know, and staggering in. And so I didn't finish. Because many of them, like happened many times in my life, I was asked not to return. And so what I did was, my hero was in the car business. And Joe was running a dealership. And so I told him, I said, man, I'm not sure what I'm going to do because, you know, I said, I got to work. And I said, maybe I can sell cars. And he goes, yeah, you'd probably be pretty good at it. And so... anyway, I took, but he wouldn't hire me. You know, he said, you're going to have to go somewhere else to get a job. Well, I got a job selling cars. And the things I liked about it was, this is back in the 70s, was that it was acceptable to drink and have outside issues. So it was really kind of right up my alley. I thought, this will work and work very well. The problem was, is once again, I was an overachiever, and I drank a little more than most folks did. And I started losing jobs. And for me, about 6 months to a year, if I had a year job, I was really doing a good job, you know. Sorry about that. Anyway, they took in, I remember I was working at I started selling Toyotas, and that was back in the 70s when Toyotas, it wasn't even cool to sell Toyotas then. You know, they were, it wasn't the car to own, but, you know, they had a hybrid pickup truck with ugly tail or turn signals on the fenders and that. But anyway, that's what I was doing. And I was working in Southern California, where I was from, in near Disneyland at Anaheim Toyota. And in those days, Toyota dealerships were usually old buildings. They weren't these big, pretty buildings like Toyota makes them build today. And they were just dumpy little stores is what they were. And I go to work in my first day, and this guy comes up to me, and he says, "Hey," he says, "you want to go get some lunch?" And I said, "Sure." I said, "You want me to go get a car?" And he goes, "No, we don't need a car. We're just going to walk." I said, "Where are we walking to?" I said, "I really don't walk a lot of places." And he says, "No, just next door." And I said, "Isn't that a bar?" He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "But they got a Polish sandwich for 35 cents and 25-cent draft beer." I said, "It's okay if we drink?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah." He goes, "You'll run into Fred." Fred was the owner of the dealership. "And you'll run into Fred several times during the day over there having a beer." I said, "This is great. Man, I have died and gone to heaven. This is the perfect place for me." It got to be that I used to park my car in the Wagon Wheels parking lot, not the dealerships, because before coming into work, I went in there. The bartender and I had a very interesting relationship. We didn't communicate at all because we had nothing. I didn't care what he had to say, and he didn't care what I had to say, so there was no reason to talk. But when I would shadow the door, he would line up four glasses of beer. I would put my dollar on the table. I would drink those. That was my breakfast of champion before going in to sell some cars. And then I'd come back periodically during the day, and he'd just line those up. Well, after a while, they, again, thought it was probably best that I leave, that I just drank too much. And a lot of folks thought that was a little offensive, some of the customers, and I can't imagine why, but actually I can, obviously. But so that's kind of how my drinking went. And then I came up with my first brainstorm. Because, see, I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous when I started losing these jobs, keeping in mind that I've got a big brother who is on the program. And Joe was, at that time, didn't know about our tradition about attraction instead of promotion, and he was trying to promote, and he was going to be Alcoholics Anonymous' missionary, and he was going to, you know, bring in as many as he could. And so he was promoting AA, and I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous. The problem that I had with Alcoholics Anonymous when I first came in, because I came for, I guess, about 10 years, because I attended my first meeting at 19, and I got sober when I was 29. And when I first showed up, back in the 70s, there wasn't a whole lot of young people in AA at that time. And I walked in, and they were all kind of old people like me now, you know. And I looked around, I thought, well, my God, if I was that age, I'd quit drinking too. What do you got to live for, you know? And these people were sitting there, and I didn't want to stop drinking. I just wanted to be able to control my drinking. I just wanted you people to teach me how to drink. And unfortunately, you didn't do a very good job, because I wasn't able to control my drinking. And I would come and I would get 30 days. A couple of times I had 60 days. I never had any sobriety or any peace, any serenity. It was all just white knuckle and just staying sober. And I usually went for a reason other than to help myself. It was usually so I could keep a job or if I could keep a relationship, something like that. And so I came up with my first brainstorm. And I realized the problem was I was living in Orange County, California, about 20 minutes from Huntington Beach, or Newport Beach, rather, and I didn't make enough money to live there, I didn't hang with the right people, and I didn't drive the right cars, and I needed to get out of there. That was the problem. That's why I drank as much as I drank. So I moved to Reno, Nevada. And if any of you are ever trying to do a little controlled drinking, a 24-hour town is a perfect place to do it because, you know, I'm used to California. At 2 o'clock, they slap you on the fanny, told you had to go home and couldn't have any more until 6. And Reno, they just kept serving you drinks. And so while I was there, there was many mornings that I would leave the I used to drink at this one casino, and I would leave the casino, and the sun would be coming up. And I thought, oh, nuts. And I'd look at the watch and go, oh, man, I got 20 minutes to get to work. So I'd just go to work. Well, I was working at a Ford store that was, and I was selling used cars and new trucks. And they were building a new dealership. So we were down on this gravel lot that they had graded off with a trailer. And the managers would sit behind this glass area of the trailer, and I would walk in one side, walk by their glass, wave at them so they'd see I was here, walk out the other side and go out to a van conversion, climb in there and go to sleep for a while. And it worked rather well unless somebody was trying to show and sell the van. You know, because, you know, people were looking for a van, not, they didn't want a, you know, an extra person to go along with it. They had their own family. And so salesmen were asking me to get out of there and drag me out, and it just, that just went on and on. So finally they came to me and they said, Jack, you got two choices. One, you either got to stop drinking or you got to get another job. So the person I always turned to was my childhood hero. So I called Joe and tell Joe, and I said, hey, I'm losing my job. And he says, well, he says, I'll get a van, I'll come up and get you. And so he came up into Reno and picked me up and what few belongings I had. We loaded up in the van. And from Reno to Orange County is about a, I think it was about a 12-hour drive. And it was the longest drive I ever had in my life, because I'm driving along and I've got 5 years worth of Alcoholics Anonymous coming here on my left side. And we know how that is, right? And it's like, oh, come on, you know? But the trip gets worse, because sitting directly behind me is his black belt Al-Anon wife. So I got Al-Anon here, AA here, and I'm done. I mean, I really just want to die. I'm like, man, can we just get there? Now, I have no car, I have no place to live, and I need both. So Joe says, you can come stay at my house, provided you go to meetings, and you don't drink. As soon as you drink, you're out. It's fair enough. So I take use one of his cars to go look for a job, and I go back to a Toyota dealership, because I like Toyotas, and I did fairly well with them, and I had a good reputation, other than I was a drunk. Well, I went to this one Toyota dealership, and they hire me, and the guy's giving me one of the salesmen giving me a little escort or a little tour of the store, showing me where the bathrooms are and the light switches and where to park and all that stuff. And there's a old refrigerator in the back of the showroom, and I said, what's with the refrigerator? And he said, well, you know, you bring your lunch, put your lunch in there. And he said, some of the fellows like to put a beer or two in there. And, you know, during the day when it's hot, they'll, you know, get a beer. I says, yeah, we can have beer here, you know. And he goes, well, you can't drink with customers and you can't drink at your desk. But if you want to have a beer, you can go out in the back in the service department and drink a beer. That's perfect. Well, these guys would come in, and on Mondays, they'd usually bring a six-pack of beer, and their six-pack would last them a week. My six-pack would last me about 2 hours. And so after a while, of course, once again, it was time for me to move on and go. And that's kind of how my drinking went, was that's what was happening. In between AA, and I was usually in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was unemployed. And then I'd get a job, and then, of course, then I didn't need AA anymore because I got hired. So then I'd stay sober for a little bit, and then I'd get drunk again. And, you know, and every time I came into these rooms after being back, because I always went to the same meetings, and that was I don't know if that was a good thing or a bad thing, but they would always welcome me back. They'd usually tell me to just shut up and sit down because, you know, I had nothing that they needed to hear, you know. They would, of course, in those days, you know, the old-timers were they were pretty tough, and, you know, and I had some outside issues that they told me that they didn't care about, and they had meetings for that elsewhere, and that's where I could discuss those. So it's best if I just sit down and shut up. And then I came up with my next brainstorm, and I figured that my problem was I needed responsibility. I needed to be married, and I needed to have a family, because if I was married and had a family, I wouldn't drink like that. I know I wouldn't. And so there was a young lady that I had dated off and on for about 5 years. And this little girl was madly in love with me. She thought I hung the moon. And she was a little sweetheart. What a great girl she was. And so I called her up, took her out to dinner, and told her that I wanted to marry her. And she was elated. And I told her the reason I wanted to marry her was because I always did much better when I was seeing her. And not at any one time did I ever tell her I loved her during that time of asking her to marry me. And her and I later on, in years later, talked about that. And she kind of said how foolish that probably was, that she married me when I didn't tell her, hey, I love you and I want you to be my wife. It was that, you know what, I seem to sell more cars, my drinking's a little more in check, and I think I need you, right? Well, any of you that have ever tried a relationship to fix your drinking, that usually doesn't work real well. And so my AA visits were how a lot of us come on court cards. I came on a wife card. Mine was, you know, I would start drinking quite a bit. Gail would say, you need to go to some meetings. While we were married, my daughter was born. And my daughter was the world to me. That little girl, I would have done anything in the world for her that I could. The problem was, is I couldn't stop drinking for her. And she saw some very terrible things, some terrible things I did with her mother. She saw things that no little girl should see. And she idolized me. And I remember my wife finally got to the point, and she says, you know, Jack, she goes, how about if you just don't drink before noon? You know, just, she goes, I know you can do that. So I said, okay, I can do that. Well, what happened was, is before she would go to bed, because she would usually sleep till about noon. Well, then after a while of asking me not to drink till noon, she started counting how many beers were in the refrigerator. And this one Sunday morning, I get up, and my little girl gets up, Heather, and she says, Daddy, can I have some cereal? And I said, sure. So I go, and I'd made a pot of coffee. And I open up the refrigerator, get the milk, and the beer's there. And I want a beer. I just want to drink. And I look at the watch, and I've got like 4 hours. And I'm thinking, man, it's not going to work. So I sat there, and I said, Heather, I said, instead of cereal, would you like to get some of those little powdered sugar donuts you like? Oh, yeah, Daddy, I'd like to. I said, come on, we jump in the car and go. In the state of California, you can start buying alcohol at 6 a.m., or at least when I was there, you could. And so we go up to the 7-Eleven, and she picks out her little donuts. And I said, okay. I said, now, there's a little connection on, or, you know, deal on this. I said, you can have them donuts, but you can't tell Mommy that I'm buying this beer. She said, okay. So I take and I go to the garage and I drink my six-pack, and my wife still hasn't woke up yet. So now it's, you know, the pump's primed. It's okay. It's close enough. It's about 10 to noon. I go get me another beer. My wife comes to the garage door. She's standing in the garage. I'm drinking this beer. Oh, and I took and I poured half the pot of coffee down the sink so it looked like I'd been drinking my coffee. And she says, she looks out there, and I am drinking that beer, but it was pretty close to noon, and she goes, I just want to let you know how proud I am of you. And she goes, how much I love you, and that you love Heather and I enough, that you will not drink until noon. I knew you could do it. I'm so proud of you. This little girl, sorry, I'm a crier. This little girl, my little daughter, looks up at me, and it's like, aren't you going to tell her? You know, and here I am, I'm teaching this little girl to be a liar and to lie to her mother. And, of course, I don't say a word. Well, we end up, and we ended up divorcing, and it tore me up. It really did. And I finally got to a point in my drinking where, oh, one other story about my little daughter. My in-laws drank at anything. If it was, Christmas, you know, holidays, deaths, funerals, weddings, births, it didn't matter. If it, you know, sun came up, you drank. And so they were a great place to go. And Christmas Eve, we spent with my in-laws, and Christmas Day with my folks. And so the dealership I was working at, the owner said, hey, around 11 o'clock, I'm going to bring in some catering. We're going to have some sandwiches. We're going to have some beer and wine. And, well, I'll be out of here about 1 o'clock and go spend Christmas Eve with your family. Well, I went home and told my wife that. Now, we were supposed to be at her parents' house at 5 o'clock. And I went, and sure enough, 1 o'clock, they closed the dealership up, we're leaving, and I'm walking out to my car, and one of my buddies, and I say, hey, let's go have a Christmas drink. And he goes, I'm going to go. I said, let's go have one drink. So we go up the street. We have a drink. He's getting up to leave. I go, well, hey, wait a minute. I bought that one. You're buying the next one. Come on. So he has one more with me, and he does leave. Well, I leave there about 6:30. And I get home, and my wife is livid. And we're driving over to her parents' house. And I'm drunk. She's hollering. I'm hollering. And my little girl, and that's before a lot of seatbelt laws and that, my little girl leans up on the, had the bench seat, leans up on the bench, and she says, Mommy, Daddy, let's not fight tonight. It's Christmas. That tore me up. That tore me up. Well, we ended up, like I said, we ended up divorcing. And it killed me that I wasn't with that little girl, but I just didn't have it within me to do anything about it. This was before the days of cell phones. This was my last drunk. And I was living in this motel that I wouldn't put a dog in. And that phone had rang. I'd been there about a week or so, and that phone had rang many, many times, and I never picked it up. And that day, I had said I was done, and I had a shotgun. And I took the barrel of the butt of the shotgun and put it at the floor in the wall, put the chair up against the bed, took my shoe off, had it in my mouth, and was going to use my toe to hit the trigger because I wanted to make sure that I did it right, because I didn't want anybody saying, you couldn't even do that right, could you? And the phone rang. And I do know why I answered it. God made me answer that phone. And I answered the phone, and it was my wife. And she says, Jack, before you hang up, she says, I have tried calling everybody, and I can't get a hold of anybody. I need you to come down, pick me up. My car just quit running, and I got to get to work, she says, because I can't rely on you to support Heather and I. And so I went down to pick her up. And I was working at a Chrysler store at this time, and I had four cars checked out in my name. Three of them I'd lost, and I had one, and I have no idea where the other three were. I pick her up, or I get over there, and she looks at me, and she goes, what's wrong with you? I said, nothing. Don't worry about it. I said, just don't worry about it. I said, I'm not going to be your problem anymore. And so she says, well, I'm going to drive. And so she drives, and she's in the passenger. Well, we get to her work, and by the time we get there, and see, God knew what he was doing, because nobody knew me better than this woman knew me. And she took and she grabs a key, tells me to stay in the car. I don't know where I was going to go. She took the keys, and she said, I'll be right back. And she went in and said she had to have the day off. And so she comes back to the car, takes me to her place, and we're trying to get into rehabs. Now, keep in mind, in 1986, there wasn't a lot of rehabs. There was Betty Ford out in Palm Springs, out in California. Well, I didn't have the money for Betty Ford, plus I wasn't a celebrity. So, that's what you had to be to go there anyway. And my insurance wasn't going to cover it. Some of the hospitals had some deals. Most of them was they put you in the psych ward. But they had, one of them would say, well, you know what, you sound like an alcoholic and we deal with drugs. Or they'd say, we deal with drugs and you sound like an alcoholic, and it was vice versa. And one of them said, well, we got an outpatient program. And an outpatient program just wasn't what I needed. I needed to be locked up somewhere where somebody was watching me all the time. And so Gail, who was my first wife, said, let's call Joe. And I said, I don't want to call Joe. So, once again, I relied on my hero, and I called him, and he gave me a phone number of a place out in Hemet, California, out in the desert, called Double Check Retreat. Double Check Retreat is a no-frills rehab. You go out there, you don't have to pay your bill if you don't have the money. They hire you out every day for minimum wage. You go do whatever manual labor they can hire you out at, and that's what pays your bill. Double Check was a little disappointing here. Just the other day, April 1st, they closed. And I was pretty disappointed to hear that. They didn't really close. They sold it to another company, but And they were like a nonprofit who was founded by a member of the fellowship, which was really kind of neat. But anyway, so I went out to double check, and I spent 38 days out there. But how I got in there was when I called, I talked to Jim, who was the assistant manager, and he says, well, first he talks to me and asks me all these questions. He goes, man, you really sound like you could benefit from this program. And he says, but I don't have a bed. And I says, why did you just waste 30 minutes of my time if you don't have a bed? He says, whoa, hold on. He goes, I promised the bed to a guy coming in from Palm Springs. He goes, lots of times they don't show up. He goes, call me at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. I'll let you know if he showed up. If not, the bed's yours. And I said, okay. So I call him. Well, my wife lets me stay on her couch. And her boyfriend keeps coming by about every hour. He's nervous as can be. All I want to do is drink. They won't let me drink. He don't like me being there, you know. And, I wasn't much of a threat. I was a basket case. But anyway, 7 o'clock in the morning, I don't have till 9. I call out and talk to Jim, and Jim gets on the phone, and they go grab him out of the mess hall, and he comes, and I said, hey, this is Jack Winley. I said, I was calling to see if you got that bed. And he says, well, to start with, USOB, I told you to call me at 9. You just interrupted my breakfast. Well, that kind of hurt my feelings. So I called him an SOB, and I told him, hey, well, I don't have till 9 o'clock. And then he laughs at me. And he starts laughing. Well, I really don't like being laughed at. And he says, man, he goes, you sound like you're ready. He goes, guess what? The guy didn't show up. You have till 12 o'clock or I give your bed away. I said, okay. So I asked my wife if I can have some money for gas. She won't give me any money. I said, don't give me any money. Just follow me down and put gas in the car. She goes, no. And, she wanted to use the money for something stupid like food and milk or something. I don't, And I said, this is important. Well, I went once again to Joe, and I called Joe, and he says, I'll be right there, and I'll get you out there. It was about an hour and a half drive from there to double check, and Joe took me out there. And if he said it once, he must have said it about 60 times. He goes, Jack, this is a spiritual program. Thankfully, I didn't know what he was talking about, because if I had known I was going back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I probably would not have gone. And I was there about 4 days, and I was sitting in a meeting, and I was back there, and when I heard him reading the steps and all that, and I'm like, this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked over the guy, and I said, I got to get out of here. And he said, why is that? I said, this is AA. He goes, no kidding. And I said, you don't understand. It doesn't work for me. I said, man, my brother's been real successful. He's got about 5 years, hadn't had a drink. And I said, but I've been trying this for like 10. I said, it don't work. It just doesn't work. And he says, I don't know what you believe in or if you believe in anything, but he says, what you need to do is you better hope it works, because this is the last house at the end of the block for you. Now, I didn't have a problem believing in God. I was scared of God. And that night, I left that meeting. I got on my knees, and it's probably the first time I ever really went to God. I mean, I had all those prayers all the time when I was drinking. God, get me home and I won't drink again, But this one was sincere. And I got on my knees and I started out my prayer to him. And I said, God, I'm sure I'm a real disappointment to you. You probably don't even like me. And I'm not asking for forgiveness because I don't deserve it. But I just don't want to drink anymore. And I'll do whatever I have to do not to drink the rest of my life. And things started happening at that time. And things just started happening. I spent 38 days there. I got out. My wife wanted me to move back home, wanted to see if, because it was close to Christmas. I got sober in October, and my daughter wanted me home, and so I did. And I couldn't get a job at a dealership. I got this crazy job at one of the motion picture labs down in Hollywood. I was working from... I worked from 8 at night to like, or 7 at night to 4 in the morning. And I'd worked there once before, and the guy who hired me, who was my boss, I said, Bert, what kind of shift is this? It's not a swing shift. It's not a graveyard shift. What is it? He goes, it's a jack shift. And I said, what do you mean a jack shift? And he says, you need to get off work after the bars close so you don't drink. I said, well, Bert, how about before work? He goes, oh, you won't drink before work. I'm like, okay. So I do, and I go to work. And that was another one of those God shots, because what happened was that it afforded me the ability to be at a 6 a.m. meeting in the morning Then I'd go home, I would sleep for a few hours, and I could go to a 12 o'clock meeting. Then I could go sleep for a couple more hours and then go to work. And that's what I did. And on Saturdays and Sundays, I attended 3 meetings. And I did that for a while. And one night I was at the, I was there and at work, and I got this very strong impression that I needed to go home. And I drove home and walked in, and my wife and the man who she eventually married were in bed together. Now, I was sober about, I guess I didn't quite have 90 days yet. And I always in my life before always said if I ever walked into that experience, I'd grab the biggest thing I could and crush both their skulls. But you people told me that before I did anything, I called my sponsor, and I didn't make any decisions. And my sponsor was real, I mean, he was perfect for me because he didn't leave anything for me to guess or think about. He says, you don't make any decisions other than what brand of toothpaste you use. And he goes, and I would really rather you just called me before you change brands, you know. So I knew that I wasn't supposed to do anything on my own. And thank God, because, see, I told God that I would stay sober. I wanted to stay sober, and I would do whatever I had to do, and I was willing to do it. And see, and all I could hear was my sponsor. So all I did is I said, I can't believe you're doing this. And I turned around and walked out, and I called my sponsor. My sponsor was a highway patrolman, California Highway Patrol, and everybody used to think it was really crazy that, you know, that the two of us were together. And at our home group, we had a coffee bar, and he took a key one day about 2 days later and slid it down the thing. And I said, what's that? And he goes, it's a key to my house. He goes, I don't have a bedroom for you, but I got a couch. Just don't be a pig. I says, okay. And that's what I did, and I moved in. And one night, y'all had those drunk dreams after you got sober, you know, well, they're such a pain. And one night I'm laying there on the couch, and he had been to the dry cleaners, and he had a hall tree, and he had his uniforms hanging up there. And I had this dream that I had gotten drunk. And I woke up, and my eyes focused on that patch, that California Highway Patrol patch, and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm in jail. What did I do? And then I realized where I was, and I'm like, oh, thank you, Lord, you know. So everything was cool. But that little girl, I started having daughter-daddy dates with her. I was able to walk her down the aisle when she got married. She asked me to do so. I actually got custody of that little girl when I was 3 years sober. And that was another one of those God shots, because I had her for about, I remarried, and my ex-wife remarried, I remarried, and then I got custody of my daughter, Heather. And about a month after I had custody of her, her mother died of an aneurysm, my first wife. And, you know, and that was another one of those God things, because she was able to take, and even though she had a room at our house, she had to change schools. God knew that she didn't need to change schools, lose her mom all at one time. I mean, it was close enough as it was. But you know what was interesting was, is when we got the phone call that she died, it was about 11 o'clock at night. And I had to go in, wake that little girl up, and tell her. And so the three of us, we got a sitter for the other kids, and my wife and Heather, my daughter, and myself, we went down to the hospital. They asked us to come down. My ex-sister-in-law called me. We went down there, and they're all in a room, and they're all coming up, hugging my neck, hugging Heather. And I look over in the corner, and her new husband's sitting there, and they hated him. Because somehow they found out that they were dating when we were still married, so they thought they were God, so, you know, they weren't going to forgive him, so, you know. And I look over, and the guy's crying, and he's all by himself. I went over there. I put my arms around him. I told him I loved him. I told him how sorry I was for his loss. And you know, and that was because of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was this program. See, because prior to that, I mean, I wouldn't have spit on him to put the flames out if he was burning to death. I couldn't stand this man, you know. But you people told me I lost the luxury of harboring a resentment. I couldn't have them anymore. And so I couldn't resent that. And I told him, I said, is there anything I can do for you? And he said, will you go in the room with me? And I said, sure. And I went in there. And I remember looking down at her and I was thinking, thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. See, because I got the opportunity to make amends with her. We were friends again when she passed. And what a blessing that was. What a blessing that was. And when I made amends with her, she made amends with me. And I told her, I said, I don't care about that stuff. You know, I'm worried about my side. You know, she said, well, I have to worry about mine. Well, my next wife ended up, my second wife came down with breast cancer right after my son was born, my little sobriety baby. And how fun that is, because he's 25 now and has never seen his dad drunk, which is, you know, a blessing. And he's given me two neat little grandkids, which is cool. So anyway, Debbie comes down with cancer, and in 2001, she passed away. And when she passed at the hospital, when we got the phone call, it was my daughter, her daughter, my sponsor. At the funeral, it was packed. The preacher comes up to me afterwards and he says, who in the world are all these people? Because there was people in jeans, T-shirts, sandals. There was a naval officer. Some of you remember, there was a guy who was, he was an officer with the Navy, and he was there. And so it was, you know, just like an AA meeting, you know, and we were all there. And he's, who in the world are all these people? And I said, those are my true friends. You know, those are my friends. And so that's kind of, you know, that was another one of those little thorns. But see, God doesn't give us anything that he can't help us out of. You know, provided we just do some of those little things. And then what was interesting was that I remarried again, you know. And this lady, I wasn't going to get married again. I mean, I really wasn't. And I said, you know what, this, I don't need to keep doing this. You know, God's trying to tell me I shouldn't be. And my daughter said, Mom didn't want you by yourself, because she called my second wife Mom. And she said, Mom didn't want you by yourself. You need to get married again. And so 4 years ago, last month, I met Bridget, who, Bridget apologized for not being here, but she wasn't getting out of bed at 3:30, so, you know. So, but anyway, and I met Bridget, and September, we had been married for 2 years. And she had lost her husband after 21 years of marriage to an automobile accident, and we are having the time of our life. And it's all because Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because the change that's taken place in me. You know, today, pretty much I'm where I'm supposed to be. You know, if I tell you I'm going to be there, I'm usually there. There's usually something major that's happened that has prevented it, and I certainly try to address it prior to the time. When I lived in Atlanta, this company I worked for, they transferred me to Atlanta, and I'll share this and then wind this thing down. But I got involved in a church, and you know, the Big Book talks about us sometimes going back to our childhood religions or finding a religion and hooking up with that, and I did. And they found out about my membership of AA, and they gave me an assignment as the Southeast Regional Program Coordinator for this addiction recovery program. So I went all over the Southeast speaking, training their facilitators and that for meetings. And what was interesting was, well, it wasn't interesting, but I kind of backburnered Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd kind of go to an annual meeting. Because I was doing all this other stuff. And this is about 7 years ago. So, and I get a phone call one night, and it's this lady. And she says, Brother Jack, she goes, my husband's back doing whatever. And in the meeting, it was every addiction,
You know, it didn't matter what it was. Porn, drugs, booze, it was everything. You know, eating, whatever. And so I'm sitting there, I said, well, I says, you know, is he reading the material? And she says, well, I don't know. I said, is he praying? She goes, I don't know. So I'm sitting there, and this was another God shot. And she says, do you think it would be helpful if he went back to those meetings? And it was like I got slapped in the head, and I'm thinking, I need to be in those meetings. I need to be in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, the thing that saved my life. And so the next day, I found a meeting that I hadn't been to an Atlanta meeting in Buford, Georgia, the Serenity House. And I went at 12 o'clock, and this gentleman was in there, and he's sharing, and his work didn't allow him to be at the noon meeting, and he happened to be there for the first time. Said he got sober in Memphis, Tennessee. Well, I'd lived in Memphis and moved over there. He was in the car business. I was in the car business, and he had a very strong program. And you could just tell the way he was talking. And I went up to him afterwards and started talking to him and asked him to be my sponsor. And he's my sponsor to this day. And you know, he developed lung cancer, and they ripped out one of his lungs. And I remember going up to him, and I said, and he always answered. Somebody, when I went up and asked how they were doing this morning, he said, just right. And I went up to Art, and Art always says, I'm just right. It made me think, and thank you for it, because I love this man. He saved my neck. And after he pulled his lung out, I went up and saw him. I said, Art, how you doing, buddy? Just right. I said, come on, Art. You know, it's just you and me right now. We don't have to play the game. And I said, how you really doing? And he says, I'm concerned how you're doing. He goes, Jack, he goes, when are you going to get it? He goes, is there anything any worse in God's world than it should be today? I said, no. Is there anything any better in God's world than it should be today? But no. He goes, then it must be just right. When are you going to get it? You know? And the guy was a tremendous help. When I came back, started going to meetings, you know, he says, all right, he goes, you need to clean those ashtrays. I said, I don't smoke. He said, you're not doing it for you. Clean the ashtrays. So I'm cleaning ashtrays. And then at the Serenity House, at the end of the meeting, the chairperson would say, hey, I need some help cleaning the kitchen or whatever. Art would say, Jack will clean. You know, and so, but he treated me like a newcomer, and it's exactly what I needed again. And I'm grateful for him and for that and the example he was to me and is to me to this day. You know, I'm grateful for this program. This program has taught me how to, when I get pricked with a thorn, how to get through it. It's taught me that you people are my true friends. That when I'm in trouble, this is where I can come and I can get help. This is what a blessing. You know, I was looking for a new home group, and I was at the Bluff City, and Milton came by my work, and he says, were you at the Bluff? And I go, yeah. And he started talking, well, Milton's always promoting Traditions Group, and he started promoting, and so inviting me to come there, and so I ended up changing home groups and going to that, and just another God thing, because I wasn't happy after I left Atlanta. You know, it's like I said earlier, life is a bed of roses, but in order to smell that fragrance and to see that beautiful sculpture, we get pricked by a few thorns. You know, this has been a real thrill for me, and thank you for putting up with my tardiness.